Can you imagine an oncologist giving the exact same chemotherapy to every patient, regardless of if the source of the cancer was bladder, brain, or bones? No. The specific kind of chemo someone receives is not chosen just because it kills cancer cells. It's chosen because it has been proven to attack a specific kind of cancer cell that originates from a specific organ. There are dozens of FDA-approved formulations of estrogen and progestogen, yet many doctors who prescribe hormone therapy give pretty much the same thing to everyone. Every single one of these products will help get rid of hot flashes, but all hormone therapy is not the same. And there are very specific differences between individual estrogens and progestogens, which impact to different degrees on bone health, breast health, and cardiovascular health. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. A few weeks ago, I did an episode with Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and we went a little ballistic about the Lancet article titled An Empowerment Model for Managing Menopause that was anything but an empowerment model. The authors of the Lancet article basically proposed that women should just think positive thoughts, do a little cognitive behavioral therapy, and their hot flashes, vaginal dryness, and insomnia will magically disappear. The Lancet paper made a huge point of saying that menopause had become over-medicalized. I and a number of other menopause experts, such as Mary Claire Haver, Kelly Casperson, and Corinne Men, to name just a few, feel very strongly that menopause has been under-medicalized. And if men stop producing testosterone at age 50 and their rates of heart disease and bone loss dramatically increased, they would not be told to do cognitive behavioral therapy. So a group of us wrote a rebuttal to the Lancet article, and over 200 menopause experts signed in support. Our rebuttal was just published in Ms. Magazine, and I'll put a link in the program notes so you can take a look. I'm also going to put a link to the list of clinicians that signed in support of the rebuttal. So in timing that was pretty amazing, another paper was published on the heels of the Lancet article that supported the benefits of hormone therapy, both in terms of being the most effective way of managing symptoms, but even more important, the impact on long-term health and longevity. The study was based on the medical records of millions of women who were still taking their estrogen after age 65, with significant reductions in multiple types of cancer, heart disease, dementia, and overall mortality. But one of the drawbacks to that large study was that multiple different formulations of hormone therapy were included. Some women took oral estrogen, some used transdermal, some took estradiol, others used conjugated equine estrogens, which brings me to another paper that was recently published and the topic of today's episode. Dr. James Simon and Dr. Barbara Levy's groundbreaking paper titled The Contemporary Approach to Hormone Therapy was published last month in the widely read journal Obstetrics and Gynecology. Their paper explained the nuances of the different commercially available hormones. The premise of Dr. Levy and Dr. Simon's work is that it makes no sense that the woman who's trying to deal with hot flashes but also wants to reduce her risk of breast cancer is usually given the same prescription as the woman who wants to get rid of her hot flashes but is really concerned about her cardiovascular risks, blood clots, or significant bone loss. According to Dr. Levy and Dr. Simon, instead of giving the same thing to everyone, clinicians should prescribe hormone therapy based on someone's specific medical history, genetic makeup, and what they're trying to accomplish. In other words, precision menopause management is the true contemporary approach to hormone therapy. In last week's episode, I had a conversation with Dr. Simon about the impact of hormone therapy on cardiovascular health, with a deep dive into when it's okay to start hormone therapy after the age of 60. In today's episode, we're going to continue the discussion and go through the specific differences between estrogens and progestogens in terms of the impact on breast cancer and bone health. Before I bring in Dr. Simon, let me tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Simon is a clinical professor of OBGYN at George Washington University and the author of hundreds of scientific papers. He's that guy that knows the data. He's that guy that every single expert in the menopause world respects. He's that guy who's participated in research of virtually every type of hormone therapy available and has authored so many of the important articles written in the menopause space. Dr. Simon and I actually met a long time ago when we were both asked to speak on a panel to discuss the first transdermal estrogen gel, Estragel. And I was more than a little intimidated when I realized that the other person I was on the panel with did the actual research on that product and was a true hormone expert. I felt like a total fraud and imposter. But as is his way, Dr. Simon bailed me out more than once and made me look like I knew what I was talking about. Since then, we've appeared on many panels together, and while I know a lot more now than when we first met, I always, and I mean always, learn something new from Dr. Simon. And anytime a woman in the Washington, D.C. area is looking for someone with expertise in menopause care, I can't imagine referring to anyone else. We cover a lot, so at the end, I will do a wrap-up summary of our discussion. And with that, I would like to bring in my friend and my colleague, Dr. James Simon. So, hi there, Jim.
Lauren, that was a lovely introduction.
All true.
Thank you so much. And I remember that first time when we were talking about Estragel. And I don't remember it the same way that you do, but I do remember that it was a lot of fun working with you back then.
Come on, be honest. When they said that this is the person who's on the panel with you, didn't you kind of think like, who's that?
No, not a bit, actually. I do remember it very fondly, and I also am very pleased to be here and to share some time with you. And I completely agree with the kind of insulting series of articles in The Lancet. I was very upset by them, and I really do think, even though Dr. Barbara Levy and I wrote this paper, which we're going to talk about, and we knew nothing about what was going on in The Lancet, I do think one of the reasons that we wrote this paper was to give prescribing in the trenches OBGYN doctors the tools that they would need to really look at menopause and hormone therapy and help their patients decide what was best for them.
Well, and that's really the beauty of this article, because so many articles talk about the risks and benefits of hormone therapy and give people a general idea. But this article does such an elegant job of laying out the differences between the hormones. And let me start with the statement that began the article that says, quote, "All hormones are not equivalent any more than all anti-seizure medications or all antihypertensives are equivalent. They have different pharmacodynamics, duration of action, and affinity for receptors, among other things, all of which translate to different risks and benefits. Consideration of treatment with the right formulation, at the right dose and time, and for the right patient will allow us to recommend safe, effective, and appropriate treatment for people with menopausal symptoms." That kind of says it all. I mean, can you imagine a cardiologist who only prescribes one antihypertensive and that's it? You walk in the door. "Well, ma'am, you've got high blood pressure. I'm going to give you a beta blocker. End of story." But that's what happens in the menopause world, right? I mean, how many patients have you seen that were put on the only app that their doctor knew about?
So I think it's very important that your audience appreciate that they are so different from even their sister, maybe even their twin sister, but they're certainly different from the woman down the street and the last patient that their doctor saw. And they deserve individualized care to get the best results for them, not for someone else, not for some average person, and not for the person who is in the study, who may be very, very different than they are and have very different goals in their treatment. Yeah. And I hope that we will empower them to demand what is optimal for them. And if their practitioners don't know, then these women will either seek additional information or push their practitioner to get the information for them.
Well, you're awfully optimistic to think that the practitioners out there in the world are going to respond to a patient saying, well, what are my options? By, oh, I'm so glad you asked. Here's the 15 different kinds of hormone therapy, and let's figure out what's right for you. So this is what I'd like to do now. I want to go through some of the points in the paper. We're not going to be able to go through the whole paper because it is long and comprehensive. So every menopause expert needs to read the whole paper. But there's a few things that I would like to discuss, starting with not all hormones are the same and that there's different kinds of estrogens and different kinds of progestogens. So let's start with talking about the difference between estradiol and conjugated equine estrogens, commonly known as Premarin, specifically about breast cancer risk, because that's always top of line. I mean, every single woman who's listening to this, who's listened to any of my other podcasts, knows that estrogen decreases the risk of breast cancer. But having said that, there is a difference between a beta estradiol and Premarin. So talk about that a little bit.
Certainly. The misconception on all estrogens, before we dig down to the differences in these two, is a misperception that came from the fact that estrogens are growth factors. And estrogen makes everything grow. It makes your bones grow. It makes your skin grow. It makes your hair grow. It makes your vaginal cells grow. It's a good growth factor, and that's what it does in most of nature. And the making of a breast cancer that's already there grow is not the same as causing the breast cancer from the beginning. That's a very important point that needs to be stressed. But most importantly, as it relates to otherwise healthy women, estrogen can cause a pre-existing breast cancer to grow enough to be found on a routine mammogram. And so it would appear that the estrogen caused the breast cancer because it wasn't there 2 years, 5 years ago when this woman was not on estrogen. But that doesn't mean it caused the breast cancer. That's number one. Number two, many studies document that Premarin or conjugated equine estrogens, not with progesterone, but the estrogen itself, may in fact have some anti-estrogenic properties and anti-cancer properties in the breast. And here's what I would say the best information suggests. It suggests that estradiol, bioidentical estradiol, the same estrogen that women make all of their lives when they're menstruating, is neutral in the breast. It's neutral for cancer. It may actually reduce cancer, but at least it's neutral for cancer. And the best data we have is that Premarin or conjugated estrogens, when used alone, may actually reduce the risk of breast cancer because it has these tamoxifen-like or SERM-like properties. And we know that tamoxifen is used as a treatment for breast cancer. So it seems to have some similar activity in the breast, actually reducing the risk of breast cancer. It's not a cause of breast cancer. We got to get out of that.
No, we got that it's not a cause of breast cancer, but it is not often that we hear the differentiation between estradiol and the conjugated equine estrogen, because so many women have this idea, well, of course I want to take the beta estradiol because it's more natural. It comes from a plant and it's going to therefore be better for me than the horse urine, which is not going to be good for me. And as I have pointed out many times, and I'm sure you do as well, there's nothing more natural than horse piss. And we are a lot closer to horse urine than we are to plants. That aside, we don't really care what's more natural. What we care is what's more effective and what's safer. And what I'm hearing from you is that this idea that the plant-derived estradiol is better for us than the conjugated equine estrogen, than the horse urine, is really not correct.
Well, let's be careful. It's not correct as it relates specifically to the breast.
We're talking about breasts right now. We'll move to other parts of the body later. Right now,
but Lauren, we need to talk about the whole woman here.
Okay. I'm so glad to hear you say that. The woman is just not her breasts. Thank you, Dr. Simon.
The point here is that we need to think about hormones in the whole woman, and for a woman who might be at slightly higher risk of breast cancer, or who thinks she is, or is fearful of using hormones unless there's data that can show it reduces her risk of breast cancer, one hormone that would say Premarin might be better for her or her thought process than the natural or more natural bioidentical estradiol. Another woman may be at risk for some other problems. And for her, bioidentical estradiol might be safer, or even a non-oral form of that same bioidentical estradiol may be what's better for her. These are the nuances that we need to make sure our practitioners appreciate, and by the way, were emphasized in the paper we're talking about.
Exactly. I mean, that's really what the paper was about, is all hormones are not created equal, and that we have an obligation to understand the differences between these different forms of estrogen and the progestogens, because the devil is in the details and it does make a difference. So sticking with breast cancer risks for another minute, let's talk about the fact that women, of course, who have a uterus need to protect that uterus when they are using estrogen. Most women are using either a micronized progesterone or medroxyprogesterone acetate, commonly known as Provera. So between those two products, specifically about breast cancer risk, what do we know?
So we know that natural bioidentical micronized progesterone has very little, if any, impact on the breast. It's really very neutral in breast. The synthetic progestogens, and specifically medroxyprogesterone acetate, has a strong proliferative effect on breast tissue, both normal breast tissue and abnormal breast tissue. And so it appears to be bad for breast cancer, even though it's unclear whether it independently causes breast cancer itself. Either way, it's the bad actor in the Women's Health Initiative study, not the conjugated equine estrogens, and not estrogen by implication more generally.
Right. And that's such an important point, because that's what really threw off the data and got everybody so nervous. But in fact, it was never the estrogen component. It was always the medroxyprogesterone acetate. The other option, of course, is basodoxifen, a SERM, which is the product Duavay, together with conjugated estrogens, that I did a segment about a month or so ago with our colleague, Dr. Kagan, Risa Kagan, and we went through the details of that. But really, the takeaway from all of this is, if somebody's nervous about breast cancer, the best combination for just that specific issue is conjugated equine estrogens combined with basodoxifen, the product Duavay. But of course, there's other considerations too. As you said, we have to talk about the whole woman, not just the breast. But I'm saying, mm-hmm. if it was just breast, then that would seem to be the product that is going to be the most protective, if you will.
Yeah, I think it's a highly underutilized product that's been kind of pushed to the side because of its association with conjugated equine estrogens. But I would say that your comment and Dr. Kagan's research, she was the first author on some of those projects, it's very clear that that is a anti-estrogenic product in the breast while still providing good estrogenic activity for hot flashes, for example.
Yeah, this is just such a good example of how many people have it wrong. You know, they're like, oh my God, we can't possibly use that because it's got horse urine and this is going to be bad and we want something more natural. When in fact, if you look at the data is very clear that that is the most protective combination that we have right now when it comes to breast.
One more thing about Duavy. About 20% or so of women on perfectly good estradiol and progesterone treatment have unscheduled spotting, staining, bleeding that just doesn't seem to want to come under control. And our colleague Jan Schifrin from Harvard showed very nicely in an old study that this subgroup of women have little teeny, very friable blood vessels that grow new blood vessels in the uterine lining in spite of not having anything bad going on there. And even normal uterine contractions, as would occur during orgasm or jogging or something, cause these little new blood vessels to bleed. Well, Duovy has an incredible anti-angiogenic effect, meaning it causes these little teeny blood vessels not to grow. And as a result of that, plus a variety of other important effects, has an incredibly good bleeding profile for a safe and effective menopausal treatment. So, in addition to the breast, which we've emphasized, it's really a great option for a woman that has a lot of spotting, staining, or other bleeding interfering with her menopausal life, which can be treated extremely well with this agent.
So the take-home message on that one is if you are on hormone therapy and you are walking around with a tampon or a pad every single day, no matter what you do, obviously that bleeding has to be evaluated to make sure that there's nothing serious going on. In most cases, there's not, but sometimes there is. And once you establish that there is nothing serious going on, that this is the combination which may curtail that bleeding better than other combinations.
Absolutely.
You point out in your paper that if someone develops breast cancer and has been taking hormone therapy, that they have a reduction in their breast cancer mortality rate, that the hormone therapy is protective in that setting as well. And you gave the statistic that there was up to a 50% reduction in breast cancer mortality for women who are on hormone therapy. Did I get that right?
That's about right. And I believe that it is true, but there are some statistical issues with that determination because it may be that women who are taking hormones are getting more diligent surveillance. They're probably getting their mammograms. They probably have their breast cancers diagnosed a little earlier or a little quicker than a woman who's maybe not so vigilant, getting her hormones on the black market or taking her
The black
friend's
market,
hormones or
the street
something.
corner from the guys who's got cocaine in one bag and hormone therapy in the other bag.
Could come to that. But my point here is that the average person who's getting very close supervision and care, medical care, may have a better outcome or be healthier or have some other factors that also feed into the fact that she's less likely to die from her breast cancer, not only that she's on hormone therapy.
That could be
Absolutely
true of
true.
everything of a woman who's getting hormone therapy because women who get hormone therapy tend to see their healthcare clinicians on a regular basis, which means that they
Correct.
are going to get their screening, bone health, cardiovascular risk. So even if they weren't to get their hormone therapy, they were just to pretend to go in every year, then there's that benefit. On another day, we're going to get into this whole discussion about should women stop going to the gynecologist at a certain age? Because I'm assuming that you are on the same page I am, is that death is when you stop going to the gynecologist, that there's great value in continuing routine gynecologic care long after you're no longer making babies or needing contraception.
With one possible exception, and that is you have an internist who's also providing that same care.
Well, yeah, we could talk about that. There are internists, and you and I know a few who do an amazing job, who are terrific, who are fabulous. Most internists offer you the Pap test, and they put the speculum in, and they swipe your cervix, and one and done, without ever looking at the vulva, the vagina, checking the uterus, the ovaries, etc. So Come on, it's the rare internist that offers to do any kind of gynecologic exam, much less a comprehensive exam, such as you would do or I would do. And it's the rare internist that's comfortable prescribing hormone therapy. But there are some, and I applaud your optimism and inclusiveness. Let's talk about bone health a little bit, because
okay.
I have to address the whole body. I'm listening.
I'm going to make you do it.
So we've talked about the brain. We've talked about the heart. We've talked about the breast. Now let's talk about the bones. So talk to me about the differences between the different hormone formulations, the different estrogens, and the different progestogens in terms of bone health.
Here, the estrogens are more or less the same if we can find a way to assess their estrogenicity and their dose. So bones, in my opinion, won't be opinion shared by everybody, are dose dependent in terms of how well they like estrogen. The more the better in terms of the bone, and that's for estrogen. The progestogens are very different. So progesterone is relatively neutral in bone, with one investigator having data which would suggest that I'm incorrect. Dr. Geraldine Pryor has very good data that suggests that natural progesterone is a bone-forming or bone-stimulating agent. Her data is really good. It just hasn't been repeated by another investigator. So I like to think of progesterone being relatively neutral in bone, in spite of that information. The synthetic forms of progesterone that are androgenic in addition to estrogenic, they seem to be incredibly good for bone, because androgens or male hormones are very good for bone. And that's why the average man has bigger and stronger bones than the average woman. That is an effect of their androgens. So medications that contain synthetic forms of progesterone or progestogens, like norethindrone or norgestrel, they tend to be very good for bone, but they have other adverse or side effects. And it may be that if a woman's real need for hormones is her bones, that we want to err on the side of stronger progestogens for bone and higher doses of estrogen for bone.
The concept of the progestogen being androgenic is something that is not talked about a lot, because most women, when they think of something that is androgenic, meaning kind of a male hormone thing, they think of testosterone. And we can talk about testosterone a little bit, but you're not talking about testosterone now. You're talking about progestogen. And the thing that people are more familiar with, of course, is birth control pills. And when we think in terms of birth control pills, and then some of the progestogen component is more androgenic, that's something that people talk about a lot, but we don't hear that as much with hormone therapy. And that's an important distinction.
It's an important distinction. And by and large, I'm talking about the same hormones and in birth control pills that are also in some of the combination menopause therapies that have particularly good bone effects.
Yeah.
The other thing about bone, and it's really important, is that the benefits of estrogen or estrogen and androgenic progestogen on bone are lost extremely rapidly if a woman goes off her estrogen or her combination estrogen progestogen.
You probably won't remember this, but years ago at the menopause conference, I was asked to do a panel that was supposed to address when should someone stop hormone therapy. And the idea was I was supposed to find six experts, three who would say stop it at 5 years, and three who would say take it forever. And I agreed to moderate this panel. And then I sent out emails to all of the academic menopause experts across the country and said, do you want to be on the panel? And everyone said, sure. And I said, which side do you want to be on? And everyone wanted to be on the side of taking it forever. And we had to get rid of the panel because I couldn't find one credible expert who would say you have to stop it in 5 years. Yet, how often are women told that at 5 years or at age 60 or 65 or something else arbitrary that you must go off your hormone therapy, and no one ever mentions, and that, by the way, when you do that, that you are going to start to lose bone rapidly.
And so in women who have to go off for some reason, we want to make sure that we capture the benefits on bone that she has accrued from being on her hormones with another non-hormonal agent so that she doesn't lose that benefit over the next year or so after she goes off her menopausal hormone. It's a very real example. It happens all the time. So let's imagine that Mrs. Smith has been on her hormones from age 50, and now she's 62, 3 or 4, and she develops or is found to have a breast cancer. Nearly all, but not all, breast cancers found under those circumstances will have a treatment that involves the patient going off her hormone therapy. She will lose bone by going off her hormones, and she will likely lose more bone by going on one of the treatments for her breast cancer. It's really important at the moment that she goes off her hormones that someone, the oncologist or internist, the gynecologist, et cetera, get her started on some medication, and there are a variety of them, to preserve the bone that she's gotten or maintained from her being on her hormone therapy for all those years. In addition, not only can we preserve her bone, but we can actually reduce the risk of her breast cancer metastasizing to bone by keeping her on one of those bone stabilizing agents. It's not rocket science. The data is abundantly clear.
But it never happens.
It doesn't happen nearly enough.
Yeah. But no, maybe. And you know, and it's funny because when we talk about, you give, you know, me a hard time about, we can't just talk about the breast, we've got to talk about everything else. Quite frankly, women who are diagnosed with breast cancer, that's exactly what happens. It becomes all about the breast, and no one is paying attention to not only what's going on in terms of her cardiovascular risks and her bone health. And we're not even getting into the whole sexual issues today, which is a whole nother topic. But it's a problem. It's a problem because the good news is that women are surviving their breast cancer and the treatments are working. But then we have to also look at, it doesn't do you any good to survive your breast cancer and then die of an osteoporotic fracture or cardiovascular disease. So, you know, and you do make the comment in your paper that despite 18 articles that showed a marked reduction in osteoporotic fractures, hormone therapy is not recommended by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is kind of astonishing.
No comment.
No comment. You've made your comment. That's it. I want to end by quoting you. Quote, the pendulum has swung too far towards not treating menopausal women with hormone therapy. Evidence supports the use of estradiol for osteoporosis prevention, treatment of vasomotor symptoms, and prevention of coronary vascular disease and premature death when started within 10 years of menopause. The addition of micronized progesterone further enhances bone mineral density without any increase in breast cancer incidence or mortality. It is time we listen to our patients and offer them the most effective therapy available for treatment of the whole person. Our patients deserve our best efforts to do this right. And that, Dr. Simon, is why this article should be required reading for every medical student, every resident, and every practicing clinician in this country, regardless of their specialty. And I thank you for this paper and for the work that you do and for the care that you give your patients. They're pretty lucky.
Thank you very much. I'm very proud of the paper. Dr. Levy and I spent a lot of time on it, and it's really important that it gets spread broadly. I have had very good success even giving it to patients. We tried to write it in a way that was accessible to a lot of women, a variety of educational backgrounds, and literally all practitioners.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for your time. Thank you for your expertise.
Lauren, thank you very much. And I hope to see you sometime soon.
Before I summarize the main bullet points, I realize that in Dr. Simon's article, he discussed the benefits of transdermal estrogen over oral estrogen as far as cardiovascular risk, but we never got to it. Now, in episode 51, I get into the details and nuances of transdermal versus oral estrogens, but here's just a short version. Oral estrogens travel through the stomach, then into the intestines, and then get metabolized by the liver. Transdermal estrogens, meaning patches, gels, and sprays, get absorbed through the skin and are released directly into the bloodstream. They're not metabolized by the liver. Avoiding the trip through the liver means that transdermal estrogens don't increase the risk of developing blood clots or gallstones. So for women who have gallstones or a history of a blood clot, or maybe who are at risk for a blood clot, a transdermal estrogen patch, gel, or spray is the way to go. Okay, so to summarize the points Dr. Simon made, as far as the impact of hormone therapy on breast cancer, there are three issues. One, does it cause breast cancer? Two, does it make an established breast cancer grow more quickly? And three, does it increase the risk of dying from breast cancer? Dr. Simon makes the really important point that estrogen doesn't cause breast cancer, but it can cause breast cancer cells that are already present and too small to be seen to grow and announce themselves, which is why it appears in many studies that it was estrogen that caused breast cancer. But in reality, the estrogen wasn't responsible. Estrogen really was just fertilizer so that it became detectable on mammogram. And women who take hormone therapy get mammograms more routinely than women who don't take hormone therapy, which means more breast cancers will be found. The two most commonly prescribed estrogens are Premarin and estradiol. Premarin is an oral estrogen that is composed of conjugated equine estrogens, meaning it's a combination of estrogens that's recovered from the urine of pregnant mares, Premarin, whereas estradiol is a bioidentical plant derived estrogen. Estradiol is neutral in the breast, and while it may reduce breast cancer, it isn't protective the same way Premarin is. Remember, in the WHI study that showed a reduction in breast cancer in the estrogen-only group, those women were taking Premarin. This is very different than what most people assume, that the estrogen that's most like what we make would be the most protective. But in fact, we have far more data that shows that Premarin is more protective against breast cancer than a plant-derived bioidentical estradiol. Now, at this point, I'm going to digress and talk a little bit about the horse issue. So many women say, okay, so Premarin decreases breast cancer more than plant-derived estrogen, but I love horses, and the horses that are used to make Premarin are treated cruelly, so I would never take it. This is a myth. And this is a myth that's perpetuated by an organization known as PETA, P-E-T-A, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. On their website, they state that the horses are, quote, tied in small stalls, unable to move either backwards, forwards, or sideways, or lie down comfortably. They stand with sacks strapped to their groins for months on end. To make the urine more concentrated, their water content is restricted, so the horses are constantly thirsty. The foals are considered byproducts, and most are fattened up, slaughtered, and sold for horse meat or turned into dog food. This is crazy. This is not true. I've got news for you. Those horses are treated better than most people treat their children. The farms that breed these horses adhere to a strict code of ethics that addresses the issues of exercise, water intake, nutrition, housing, and veterinary care of the brood mares. Their ridiculous website then goes on to say that there's no benefit to humans using estrogen and that hot flashes can be better controlled by eating a vegetarian diet and exercising. Right. And no, I do not work for Premarin or any other estrogen company. When it comes to progestogens in breast health, micronized progesterone is neutral in the breast, so no known negative effects. Medroxyprogesterone acetate, also known as Provera, on the other hand, has a strong proliferative effect in the breast, meaning it can make both normal breast tissue and breast cancer tissue grow. It's not clear if medroxyprogesterone acetate actually causes breast cancer, but it does cause breast cancer to grow, which again explains why in the WHI there was an increase in the detection of breast cancer in women who were using hormone therapy. So in the Women's Health Initiative study, it was never the estrogen that was the problem. It was always the progestogen, and specifically that progestogen. The best combination when it comes to preventing breast cancer is Duo-V, which is a combination of conjugated equine estrogen and basodoxifen. Basodoxifen is a SERM, SERM, or a selective estrogen receptor agonist that blocks estrogen receptors in the breast. In addition to protecting against breast cancer, Duo-V is the combination of hormone therapy that's the least likely to cause breakthrough bleeding. The details on Duo-V is in episode 114. Is Duo-V the ideal hormone therapy? And by the way, if you live in Canada, Duo-V is the same thing as Duovive, Duovive. I know this because a few days ago I was giving a lecture to a group of physicians in Canada. For women who are taking hormone therapy and get breast cancer, there appears to be a 50% decrease in mortality, but again, the data may be somewhat skewed because women who are taking hormone therapy are the women who regularly get mammograms, and so it is detected at the earliest, most curable stage. When it comes to bone health, it appears that the dose, but not the type of estrogen, makes a difference. The type of progestogen, on the other hand, does seem to make a difference. Progestogens with the most androgenic activity, like norethindrone or norgestrel, are better bone builders than natural progesterone. Those specific progestogens are in some of the combination menopause treatments, which are not frequently prescribed. Women that stop hormone therapy will lose bone rapidly. This is especially problematic in women with breast cancer who are not only taken off their hormones, but are given treatments that will further accelerate bone loss. A bone-building drug will not only reduce the risk of osteoporosis, but will also reduce the risk of the cancer metastasizing to the bone, which was news to me, always learning something new from Dr. Simon. There was so much more in this paper, and I will put the reference in the show notes, but it is behind a paywall, so you won't be able to access it. But you can give the reference to your clinician. We also discussed a lot of cardiovascular issues, but that was in last week's episode. So, same old theme. If you have a complicated medical history, you would really benefit from a consultation with someone with expertise in the distinctions between all of these options. And if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, lucky you, Dr. Simon is there. The Menopause Society website has a clinician finder, and that link will be in the program notes. But I want to talk for a second about the menopause telehealth platforms. A lot of the menopause telehealth platforms sell hormones directly to you, but that means you're limited to the ones that they sell. I work with Midi, and they're different because while it is telehealth, it's no different than going to a brick-and-mortar menopause expert. I work with Midi. They're different because while it is telehealth, it's no different than going to a brick-and-mortar menopause expert. Midi clinicians are going to do a whole health history, and they're going to get whatever labs they need to determine which specific hormone therapy is going to give you the most benefit and the least risk. And then they give you a prescription, which will be filled by an outside pharmacy. So you get what's best for you. And they take insurance, and they're now in all 50 states. All this information is in the show notes. And I know this episode was a little on the heavy side, so next week, maybe something a little lighter. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Insight Information books available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of. Took me by the hand. She told
Sometimes I feel blue. She helped me see the light.